ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Speaking Out.
We're mainly discussing land rights and economic empowerment.
Aboriginal enterprises in mining, exploration, and energy.
I'd like to talk a little bit about Indigenous constitutional recognition. Those two.
With Larissa Berendt.
It's a fresh view coming
on ABC Radio.
This is Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Berendt. It's hard to believe a year has passed and BAD is back. BAD is the annual Sydney Crime Writers Festival that highlights the new and best-selling crime authors deeply engaged with justice, Indigenous stories, gendered violence and moral ambiguity. This year's event was held in a new venue, the Sydney Mechanics School of Arts. There was so much on offer. Writing workshops, book launches, true crime walks. You could even come to a panel hosted by me. This year's panel topic was Gone But Not Forgotten, Still Seeking Justice. It explored the way that crime leaves a legacy and asks how we confront the past and what this means for our future. Two remarkable women delve into these questions, Professor Lorena Allam and Angie Faye Martin. Professor Lorena Allam is a multiple Walkley Award-winning journalist and a descendant of the Awalari and Gamilaroi people of northwest New South Wales. She has over 40 years' experience working in the media. Until recently, Lorena was Guardian Australia's Indigenous editor, and she is now a professor at the Jumbana Institute at UTS. Angie Faye Martin is a writer and editor of Cooma, Gamilaroi and European Heritage. She has a Bachelor of Public Health from QUT and a Master's of Anthropology from ANU. She spent many years in policy roles in state and federal government. Her work has been published in Meanjin, Garland, The Saltbush Review and The Rocks Remain. Malaluka is her debut novel and we'll be discussing some of the themes explored in her book.
How about we start with you telling us a little bit about where you grew up, what shaped your values, and how did you come to engage in writing, especially writing about crime?
Okay, so I grew up in Oakey, a little country town in Queensland, which is actually Garunga in Malaluka. I grew up just on a little piece of land, actually, in country, in Oakey, that my mum's parents had gifted my parents. So they were non-Indigenous farming people, and my dad's a proud Aboriginal man. So I was really influenced, actually, by both sides of my family. Obviously, today, given the topic, I'll focus a bit more on dad's side of the family. So my ancestry, my people are Cooma through my grandfather. My pop Martin was a Cooma man. And my grandmother was Gamilaroi. And so I grew up with a really strong sense of who I was. My dad told us lots of stories. Mm-hmm. He wanted us to know where we come from and the sacrifices that had been made to give us an education and the opportunities that we were able to enjoy were because of the sacrifices that the people before us had made and endured. So, yeah, grew up in Oakey. I was really influenced by both my grandmothers, especially. So both my grandmothers were avid storytellers and readers. My Nana especially, really inspired a love of reading and education and open-mindedness as well. So when I was 8 years old, my grandparents actually took me to China. They asked us, all us grandkids, we were a little bit spoiled in that way. They weren't wealthy or anything, but they believed in knowing about other cultures and how other people lived. So they asked all us grandkids, where do you want to go? And I just said, yeah, let's go to China. So they took me to China for 2 weeks when I was 8 years old. And so I grew up in Oakey, then I moved down to Brisbane, studied public health, studied development studies. I had an external focus at the time. I wanted to do international development. And I think part of me was rebelling a little bit from, I felt an enormous weight to do, how do I say it, a bit of pressure to pursue Aboriginal rights. So Dad and the family owned the Aboriginal, not owned, they managed and ran the Aboriginal Legal Service up in Toowoomba. And I felt like there was such expectation for me to study law and be a lawyer. And I'm a very conflict-averse person, and that idea just scared the hell out of me. I was like, I don't want to be a lawyer. Like, I can't do that kind of thing. And I rebelled a little bit and turned away from that, did public health, thought about foreign aid and external development studies. And then in the end, I worked for the public service, repressed all the creativity and Aboriginal kind of politics. In the end, I found creative writing. And I thought, this is my natural way to both give back to, you know, fulfill that expectation or that responsibility to tell the stories that I knew needed to be told, but in my own style with creativity and, you know, the safety and my comfort zone is obviously just being at home in my office writing. So when I found creative writing about 10 years ago, it was just so beautiful. I was like, this is what I want to do.
I'll just acknowledge that some of your family's with you today in the audience.
Yes, I'm looking at my sister and my friend Kelly and my husband.
There are many, many themes in Malaluka, and one of the threads, of course, is the crime thread. And it, in many ways, you write into the genre. But just as a reader and as a consumer of content, was crime something as a reader that you were quite drawn to or are you interested in? Where did that come from?
So I read very broadly. I do enjoy crime because I love something with like twisty suspense. But when I started writing Malaluka, I didn't actually set out to write crime. You know, I guess I was just naturally influenced by the kind of books I was reading, Gillian Flynn at the time, and the Melaleuca just gradually started fitting into that genre. And then I embraced it and I thought, you know, this is a cool genre. I'm just going to lean into that a little bit more. And also crime allows the exploration of those deeper, heavier themes, which were naturally arising for me, the racism and discrimination that I had experienced myself and seen my family members struggle and experience. Didn't set out to write about it, but I guess this is just some of these things that naturally came up for me.
And Lorena, let's just explore a little bit about what brings you here in terms of your background. Can you share with us similarly where you grew up, where your kind of values and worldview came from, who influenced you, and what led you on the path to be a journalist, and a journalist who does, you know, tough investigative journalism. You don't cover the fluffy stories, you cover the hard ones.
Yeah. Liz, when listening to Angie talk, I was thinking about how similar it was at my upbringing. We grew up in the country. My mum's family are Europeans and my father's family all come from Yuwalaray, Gamilaroi people of far northwest New South Wales. I grew up mostly with my dad's side of the family. It was a bit of a scandal when my parents got married. That was not the done thing for a nice white girl to marry an Aboriginal man. So I knew a lot about my dad's family and it's a big family. The Fernando clan is a big clan. So I had my aunties and my grandmother growing up telling me all the stories of family and history. And then my mother's side of the family. I grew up between the South Coast where my mum's people are from and the West where my father's family are from. So I got to see kind of, well, we spent more time with Dad's side, but I had a foot in both camps, I guess. And that I think made me question the kind of stories we were being told about history at school, because I was getting a very different version of stories at home from my father's family. So there was this kind of orthodox view that you got told at school, but I knew that that wasn't the truth. So I think that is what made me start to question things, and I'm a bit of a nosy Parker, really. So I think journalism was a... And I love writing, like you, words and writing was something that I felt like I needed to, like it felt important to me, it felt natural to do that. I was good at it. So those things combined, and I had the most incredible Aboriginal education assistant at my local high school, because no one in my family had ever finished high school, let alone gone to university, so I never thought it was a possibility either. And this woman just said, no, I think you've got what it takes, literally put me in her car and drove me to Bathurst to Mitchell College, which had a journalism school at the time. It doesn't any longer. It's not even called Mitchell College. I think it's called Charles Sturt University now. But I enrolled in the journalism or communications course there. 3 years later, I got a cadetship with the ABC in 1989. So, and there, I think I felt, as Angie said, I felt a responsibility to tell stories, to make a contribution, to acknowledge the fact that my elders didn't have the opportunities that I had been given. And there was a responsibility with that. But I was willing, I wanted to do this. And I could see at the time there was a desperate need for Indigenous perspectives in the mainstream media. And I had this opportunity to do that as well as build a career as a journalist. So I took that opportunity.
We'll have a bit more of a chat a little later on about some of the really important stories that you've looked at in the last couple of years. But I want to start to really dive into Malaluka with you, Angie. It's such a great book. Congratulations. I loved reading it and didn't pick the bad guy until it was clearly obvious, which is also, it was really good. I had a great time in that sense reading it. And I love how you wrote into the genre, but also there's some really great thematics and some really great characters, some that really resonated with me. And Lorena and I are both Yuwalari, so part of our country is in regional Queensland. So there was that resonance as well. But a book like this, you know, they have many seeds where the idea comes from and then it formulates over time. And I wondered if you could share with us where the seeds of Malaluka came from for you.
Okay, sure. So there were a lot of seeds, to be honest. Like I said, I started writing this about 10 years ago and I was working in the public service. And whilst that was rewarding in certain ways, I was a little bit frustrated and felt like there were things that I wanted to explore and create that I couldn't do in my everyday work. And I was reading a lot of crime at the time and I was in my early 30s and just bursting with ideas and a bit idealistic at the time. And I remember just walking around Carnegie with my husband where we were living and talking about work and politics and things that were going on. Then we were actually walking past a lot of paper bark trees and I remember just picking them and, you know, feeling the paper bark and actually literally coming up with this idea of maybe I could write a novel and, you know, the layers of people's personalities, and just got a bit carried away with this idea of authenticity and how much are people hiding from each other. And there was another, a little bit more personal story, which I'm starting to share more and more, and that is something that happened to my dad when I was a child that I didn't even realize stayed with me. And when I was about 9 years old, I remember my dad, an Aboriginal man, reaching out to his grandfather, a biological grandfather, who had more or less disowned our family. He was a rich, wealthy white man down in Brisbane, and Dad, I think, was feeling quite alone, maybe a little bit under pressure at the time with the legal service and everything. He was the eldest of 11 brothers and sisters, and Dad reached out to this man. I should say that my grandfather had passed away when I was a baby. So Dad was also a little bit alone in the sense he didn't have his dad, but he knew of this wealthy white man down in Brisbane. I remember as a kid, Dad receiving the rejection letter and being very acutely aware of that rejection and wondering why. And I had a million ideas running through my mind, like, that's when racism first kind of entered my thought. I thought, see, the racism, he thinks we want their money or he's just too busy and he knows we're a big black family and he wants nothing to do with us. And I don't think we ever even really talked about it as a family. Like, we just kind of thought, let's just move on. You know, obviously, Dad encouraged us. He didn't dwell on it. He encouraged us to move on. He's like, you know, oh, well, that avenue's been pursued and you know, not going to happen. But anyway, this theme of abandonment and family disconnections and how often that probably happens in Australian society, how often men will, you know, probably have children and don't own up to it and offspring that they don't own up to, especially now with Ancestry.com. Like, you just, I won't go into those stories, but I am actually, you know, given this link, they're starting to pop up and they're like, oh, we've got an Aboriginal cousin. And I was like, maybe if your great-grandfather had accepted that connection back when Dad reached out, you'd know why. Mm. But Yeah, so it's kind of fascinating as well. And that little seed of an idea stayed with me and I kept exploring it and came up with a crime novel.
I love writers' festivals. I love this writers' festival, but I always feel like I go to them as a reader rather than a writer. But I know there are people in the audience who probably are writers or aspiring writers. And just wonder if you could share a little bit about how, when from that moment when you thought I'm going to write a book, how did you find the discipline in a busy life? How did you find the way to craft that time for you?
It became like a compulsion. So I remember after that work, going home, and I wrote like post-it notes and all these ideas down. I wrote a few scenes. I showed it to my husband, and he said, "Oh, surprising, that's actually pretty good," because all I'd ever done before was academic writing, and I was like hungry for some kind of praise. So I grabbed that and I went and kept going with it. It did take a lot of discipline. I carved out a few hours in the evenings. I think I got some long service leave and devoted the 3 months just to doing a draft. I was very lucky that once I came up with a draft, I was awarded the First Nations, in 2019, First Nations HarperCollins Commercial Fiction Fellowship. They gave me a mentor through that. This was back when COVID just hit and couldn't do anything else because of COVID, you know, I was locked down. Worked with Amy Matthews, a brilliant writer over in Adelaide, who coached me on some writing craft techniques, but she really met me where I was at in my writing journey. So obviously I had done a master's in anthropology and development studies, so I knew the basics of writing and I had read a lot, but I just needed to cut through. Point of view was something I didn't understand, and once I got decided on my point of view, third person, you know, and my first draft, I don't know if anyone's heard of head hopping. It's when you go from multiple points of view in one scene. My first draft is just full of head hopping. Once I understood point of view and decided who was going to carry my story, Renee and Caroline, then I was right to go.
Well, that's a great segue into the next thing I wanted to discuss, which is these two characters who represent different timelines in the book, but Renee really does drive the book, and she's a fantastic protagonist, an Aboriginal policewoman. Mm-hmm. So can you tell us a little bit about how you crafted Renee and the choice to have her as a policewoman? Because of course, for a First Nations person, that brings its own set of complexities.
Yeah, so I was actually just as surprised as I think most of my family when I chose a cop to be my protagonist, because I was like, Andy, you're a black fella. Why do you want to write a cop as your protagonist? But honestly, the story is what drove it. So I realized, like, my mind when I came up with the story was very much in the 1960s. And I was like, I need someone to solve the case in the present day. So it needed to be a detective. So I created Renee. She's a policewoman, but then she also has issues with the justice system. So through Renee, I was able to shine a light on, you know, her battles with the justice system. And to do that, I drew on my own experiences, although it's much less, but in the public service, some of those frustrations. When you see resources being devoted to certain causes and attention given to certain things, obviously a much lesser extent, but I drew on that to create this character of Renee. So she ended up being a very staunch detective. I drew a lot on myself, but at certain points my mentors and writers said, Angie, she's too soft, like she's not taken enough risks. And so I realised I needed to distance myself and put Renee on the ledge a little bit more and, yeah, to make her take a bit more risk, raise the stakes as you have to in crime and build her character up a bit more. So she's very gutsy, very determined. She's also flawed. She's a bit judgmental at times. And I enjoyed exploring that because there's some people in the book that are actually non-Indigenous and really nice and mean well, and Renee gets frustrated with them. And I think it's an invitation for people to empathise with. Sometimes it's just, you feel as an Aboriginal person, you carry like a bit of a different load, and it can be really tiring sometimes, and you do get occasionally a bit short and, you know, a bit cranky. And I try to show that in some of the interactions between Renee and Stacey. Stacey's actually really beautiful, but she's just, and in, you know, I was about to say in the end, I'm at a crime writers festival, for goodness sakes. No spoilers. So yeah, that was Renee.
And Carolyn, I have to say, Renee's just a fabulous character. I just really felt like I was with her the whole time, and she's great. So I'll ask you a bit later if we're going to see her again. But before we do that, go down that rabbit hole. Carolyn, a very different character.
Yeah, and Caroline came much later in the drafting process, actually. And Caroline's more softer, idealistic, although Renee's also idealistic. Caroline is dreamy. She's romantic. She falls in love. And I feel like when I was writing it, the dual timelines, so Melaleuca goes from the year 2000 back to the 1960s, and that setting is the Yumba, which is a camp, a fringe camp, where my father actually grew up. So that's where that setting was inspired. And Caroline lives in a little hut with her sister, Millie, and her grandfather, Pa Quincy. And there's lots of scenes where I show just the give in, even though when we hear history, sometimes we think of it as just being, oh, it was awful. And it was awful back then. There was so much violence back then. But there's a warmth around the campfire with Caroline and her grandfather, and cups of tea between her and her sister, and such love between them. And I really myself, I think, healed a little bit writing these scenes. Like at certain points, I thought, oh, my God, this is so corny. Why am I writing this? But Pa Quincy calls them his granddaughters, Princess and Queenie. And I thought, oh, it's so corny, but I'm loving it too much, and I just kept going with it. So that's Caroline, yeah.
I never thought once corny, but it was clear that, I mean, what I think you've managed to do is to have the sort of two main leaders of those two different threads of your story be really strong characters in their own way. Mm. And just with Caroline, was she inspired by people that you knew?
So, honestly, at the time I didn't realise it, but now I'm reflecting, I think she's a little bit of my grandma. I think she's a bit of Nana Zona Martin Leslie. Just in her, she's quite reckless in some of her beliefs, and there's a point where she's cleaning at the house. She's a domestic at a property, and she's dusting around a table, and there's a crystal glass, and she wants to push it over, but then she'll just have to clean it up. And I don't know, there's just a real rebellion about her that, and then practicality sinks back in. But yeah, I think, but not strictly speaking, but I think that, and I imagine Caroline as being a stunningly beautiful woman, and I think my grandma definitely was as well.
It's funny how you write something and then at the end you'd done it subconsciously. I used to always say my last book was inspired by cases I'd worked on, and then realised one day that it was actually completely about me and my mother, and I'd been in absolute denial about it. It was kind of liberating when I realised that about myself. You do explore the two timelines, and that's a very tricky device in any kind of writing. How did you manage that and start to weave the stories together?
So I actually found this really difficult at certain points. I was like, why on earth did I choose to write a dual timeline crime story? But the story was just bursting out. Like it had to be told that way. I think I got the 2000 timeline straight in my mind first, and then I was able to dip back in using these techniques, and then I built the suspense like with hooks and cliffhangers. But that did take quite a bit of structural editing before I got to that point. And then eventually it just flowed nicely. So I'd have the more action-orientated scenes in the year 2000 and then the more dreamy kind of scenes in the 1960s where there was a bit less action. But it is really difficult, to be honest. Like I needed to read craft books about writing processes and map it out a little bit. And at certain points I thought, oh, why did I give myself this task? But it's worked in the end, I think.
Yeah, I think certainly when you're reading it, you don't get the sense that the writers struggled the way that you're describing it, which is a testament. But I think it's wonderful too to be reminded that this isn't an easy thing, and it's not an easy genre to write into. There's a lot of expectation about the mystery and the twists and populating a world where there's a lot of mystery, that there actually is quite a craft to it.
Yeah. I kept telling myself when I was writing it, I want to write something that I want to read. I want that twist, that, you know, the twist, the suspense, the cliffhangers and the hooks. I want it to be a page turner. And I think, like I say, sometimes I feel like I embody two people when I'm writing. There's the creative self where I will write and try not to be critical of myself at all. And then I put on my editor's hat and I go back and critique it. And usually do it on different days. So that's the process I kind of use to liberate myself from criticism.
And, I mean, there's a lot of really potent themes in the book that just come through, in some ways just because of the subject matter that you're looking at and where you've, the background of your characters and where you've placed them. Aboriginal policewoman in a small country town. So you do see an exploration of the themes of systemic racism. Mm-hmm. There's the intergenerational trauma. There's institutional corruption. How conscious were you about those themes as you were writing? Was there things that you wanted to say with the book?
I didn't want to be teaching anyone anything. There were occasionally a few times when the paragraph would slip in where I got a little bit preachy, and either I'd go back out and cut it out or my editor would do that for me. She's like, Angie, you don't need to tell people that. So I think part of me did want to get across a message, did particularly, you know, about how horrible it was before the 1967 referendum when people were living on these camps and they didn't have the census data to be able to create policies, like housing policies and education policies for these people living in the camps. I wanted to shine a light on that for my dad and his siblings and my grandparents. And that, I guess, was a deliberate to a certain extent. But the other things, especially like the horrible things that happened to Aboriginal women in this country, I actually don't feel too confident speaking about objectively. It came from a really deep place, I think, where I have seen and heard how it has happened to family members, people in my community, and it has come in a very organic, from a very organic place. I feel a little bit bad that I don't know a lot of the real case studies that you see on the news. I shield myself a little bit because it's just a bit too much, but I feel like I know it from just growing up as an Aboriginal woman.
And it does feel, without any giving away any spoilers in the end, that it is set up for that we might see Renee again?
Yeah, so I've got a... I think it's a pretty solid draft of a sequel where Renee Taylor, the protagonist, will come back. She'll go a little bit further west and solve an entirely new crime and get to know her father a bit more, her Indigenous father, and her culture a little bit more going west.
That was writer and editor Angie Faye Martin speaking about her new book, Malaluka, and its themes of systemic racism, intergenerational trauma, and institutional failures.
I refuse to believe what I see in the news. I have seen it firsthand. We know what to do. We were made for this earth and to be with each other. Oh, how grateful I am for the moments I remember when the lifeline was short and the water was too high. I saw outstretched hands and people organized. We climbed mountains for each other and stand cheek by cheek, and the strong they step in when others grow weak. And I'll grow deep, just like the trees. You could stand beside me. Together we grow steady on our feet. I'll grow deep, just like my old people did before me. You could stand beside me. Hey, together we grow steady on our feet. I've come here to learn from a river flowing change in turn. When the water was rising, I fell to my knees. I looked to the sky and prayed, stop raining, please. But the sky, he couldn't hear me or understand my pleas. So I rose to my feet, for there are people who are speaking, who know what to do. So I'll go listen, then I'll know too. And I'll grow. Just like the trees,
You're listening to Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Berendt. That was Dugan and Jabir artist Nidala and her recently released song Ground Deep. The song is an honest story of not just her connection to country, but her community as well. We're returning now to our panel from BAD, the Sydney Crime Writers Festival, called Gone But Not Forgotten, Still Seeking Justice. Professor Lorena Allam has written extensively on Indigenous issues, which we'll talk about, but I'm also keen to hear her reflections on the themes explored in Angie Faye Martin's new book, Malaluka.
I want to turn to Lorena now, and I want to ask you a bit about your journalism, Lorena, and just for people in the audience who are interested in the sorts of issues that Lorena's talking about, Lorena's writing is on the Guardian website, so you can look her up and then find the reporting that we're going to be talking about. But before we get into some of the actual cases that you've looked at or issues that you've explored, I just want to give you a moment. I think there's probably a lot in what Angie has said that resonates with the work that you've done thematically. Very, very different. Creative writing, crime genre, and then sort of journalism focused on the hard Indigenous issues. But one of the reasons we thought about putting you two together is that you actually do explore similar themes in very, very different ways. And I imagine that some of the things that Angie's talked about would have resonated with you. So I just wanted to give you a moment to see if there were any reflections about that.
I think that listening to Angie talk about her characters and how they're fictionalised, but they're very much rooted in our experience as Aboriginal people, as Aboriginal women, as the inheritors of a really complex history, a violent and difficult history, but also things that our families gave us that are really keep us strong and keep us happy and, you know, those good memories of grandparents and the love, just that unconditional love that you get from family, and that is the thing that sustains you when you are doing difficult work. And so there's creative writing about that, which in a way is kind of teaching people, giving people a space in which to experience or feel how we might have experienced the world. And it's kind of easier in a way, not easy, certainly not easier to write, but easier to experience in a novel than to read, you know, very hard hitting journalism, whether it's in The Guardian or anywhere else. But the two things are connected because one provides you with the factual basis for the fiction. And so you can't dismiss that fiction as just somebody's been making things up. So I'm thinking, you know, things like The Rabbit Proof Fence that everybody has read, but was based on Doris Pilkington's mother's experience. Those little girls did that trip three times, not just the ones that you saw in the book or read in saw in the film. In her book, she talks about those girls escaping three times, those to go home to their mothers and grandmothers. So there's a connection between fiction and fact, and particularly when it comes to Indigenous history, we're all storytellers about that. And even my investigations are based in, obviously, fact, but it is also a kind of history, telling people a story because I want them to read and understand it. They're not too dissimilar if you know what I mean. One complements the other. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's sort of what we were thinking about when we placed you two together. And I guess the other thematic that a thread through both of the work that you've done is the way in which crime against Aboriginal women, especially if they go missing and it's not treated as seriously. And you've seen a lot of that, those instances in your work. But I guess there's also a question of, that I'd love your reflections on, of how the media or journalists cover or don't cover that kind of story.
Yeah, there isn't the same attention and care given to Aboriginal women who are disappeared. They don't go, it's not something that, you know, there's an active disappearance there, not just of in the crime in which an Aboriginal woman is taken from us, but also in the way that she's disappeared by the justice system, by the policing, the inappropriate and inadequate investigations. And then the media's lack of interest in reporting those things, unless there's a salacious detail that often dehumanises the woman at the heart of a story and that woman's family who are all grieving. And so a lot of a lot of work that I've done in the past, particularly it was a project I did called Deaths Inside, which was tracking Aboriginal deaths in custody, was attempting to put a face on those numbers, that we're people, you know, with lives and disappearing us silences us in our own lives. I wanted to give people their dignity that was taken from them by the system with a project like that. I mean, it's obviously based in rigorous research and it's fact. You know, I don't want people to think it was some airy-fairy thing. It wasn't. It was a very careful and very well-researched project. But ultimately it was about putting human face to those numbers to remind people that we are, you know, those are people who are loved and missed and mourned and leave a legacy behind that is complex. And a lot of the reporting that I've done about women, missing and murdered women, is, again, that's at the heart of it, is to centre those women in those stories. They're not just a body in a bag. They're a person who had a life and is loved and missed. Yeah.
One of your recent collaborations with your colleagues was a project, The Killing Code, a very powerful project, which you can also read, but there's a series of podcasts on the Guardian website about this as well, which unearthed diaries that record outright massacres by colonial settlers. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a bit about that project and, you know, the sorts of processes you went through to, you know, to unearth these diaries?
Mm. This is a true crime story, basically, and I am in the process of writing a book about this. But The Killing Code was based on, it's part of a project called The Descendants that we did for The Guardian, which was looking at the descendants of all sides of our colonial history, massacre survivors and perpetrators. And we brought people together, often on country where the events took place, in this series that you can read on The Guardian. But the key discovery that we did during that project was this diary of a colonial settler from Geraldton who, his name was Major Logue. Major was his name, not his military title. He was a migrant from Derry in Ireland and took up land outside Geraldton. In his diaries, he writes very mundane things about, you know, I planted potatoes, the cows got out, my horse ran away, etc. Think about building a house. And then, you know, you sort of scrolling through it, about 1853, this strange code starts appearing in his diary, which is quite disturbing. We found the diaries. We translated and transcribed the code and worked out what he'd said. In effect, he was writing about killing people on the frontier using this code. It was called Pigpen. It's called Pigpen. It's a Masonic code. He was a Mason, Major Logue, and used this Masonic code. He shifted it slightly, so we took us a while to figure it out. There's YouTube videos. There's a YouTube video for everything. There's a YouTube video that helped us crack it. So we felt like this was kind of some crazy Dan Brown stuff, right? But it was real. This guy had written about it. He was sufficiently, we think, ashamed of his actions to put it in this code so that no one in his immediate circle presumably could read it. But he was so troubled by what he'd done, what he'd witnessed, what he'd been part of, that he wrote about it in code. And he wrote things like, you know, shot two over here, seized some weapons and burnt them, went down the road and shot two more. So there were a number of entries, maybe there was about 12 to 13 entries in this period between 1851 and 1853 where he was writing about this. The twist in the tale is that there was a historian in Geraldton who knew this code existed in the diary but was preparing for publication the diary with all of the coded bits edited out. And that, as far as I know, I haven't checked in the last few weeks, but that book, that publication is still going ahead. So for The Guardian, we very carefully told the story, the whole thing. I mean, the diary itself exists in its entirety in the Batty Library in Perth. So we went to the Batty Library and sat there and through the sort of microfiche, just painstakingly photographed every page of his diary, which lasted 50 years from 1850 to 1900 when he passed away. Major Logue, after taking up this land violently and killing people and dispossessing them, became the first MP for Geraldton. So, and has very well known, like, has, you know, he's a well-known colonist, He's in the Australian Dictionary of Biography. His descendants include people like Randolph Stowe. So we went to Geraldton to interview the historian who intended to edit and still intends to edit the diary with the coded sections removed because the current owner of the diary does not want that to be made public. We also met other descendants of Major Logue who do want this story told, who did want this to be told warts and all, if you like. So that formed the basis for the reporting of the killing code. And my colleague Sarah Collard first came across the code or heard about it when she was researching a story about Bootnell Springs, which was a massacre where Major Logue was involved and other white settlers around Geraldton. And the descendants of those perpetrators meet the descendants of the survivors. There was the 150th anniversary of that event and they all came together. She started talking to them all for the project, for the descendants, and one of them said, you should talk to the Logue family because they've got an interesting history. There's some diary with some code in it. And Sarah, being the brilliant investigator that she is, managed to track down the diary in the library. And so we were there literally scrolling through it, trying to work out how to decipher this crazy code. So it was Sarah's tenacity that in looking, and I think it was like the more you look at this history, the more there is to see. So if I were to write that as a crime novel, people would say that's far-fetched, which is why I think it's so important that this kind of sort of historical journalism, if you like, is done, because it might seem obvious to people who know a little bit about Australian history, but this man perpetrated these killings. He killed between 11 and 15, 16 people. Some of them he referred to by name, so he knew who they were, and disguised these deeds in his diary. I think it puts an end to this fantasy that we have that Australian history was all, it was accidental. It was a conflict and it was us or them and it was all a bit ad hoc, but this was systematic and organised, and he knew exactly what he was doing and why he was doing it, and he wasn't alone in doing that. And I think what's also important is that generations later, people are still trying to whitewash and hide that story. So I think what I'm most proud of about that story is that it shows that there's the history we are being taught, the orthodoxy around our history, you should always question that. There's always another side to the story, if you like.
One of the things, just if we can pick up on, as you say, there's a lot that comes through in that reporting and that story about what's been hidden in history, what we've tried to whitewash. Mm-hmm. But you did mention as part of it there was a coming together of the descendants of both sides. And we have seen a bit of that. That's also what happens with Mile Creek. And as you say, there's a lot about this, which is an us and them. Our history has to conquer their history. Mm. But we are seeing these spaces where the descendants of both sides come together, and it's quite a powerful and a very positive thing. And I think it's a very interesting phenomenon when we talk about truth-telling and how that could be something that is actually nation-building and inclusive. So I wonder if you could just share some reflections of what you've seen when both sides have a willingness to come together and what gets resolved through that.
Mm. The more of that I see, the more convinced I am that this is the most meaningful form of truth-telling. The big investigative sort of inquiries, the Yuruk Justice Commission in Victoria is very important, and it's found some very significant, you know, nation-changing things. But the power of that that one person to another, you cannot kind of measure the importance of that. I think when we were at Bootnell Springs, for example, we were there with the descendants of the perpetrators and the descendants of the survivors and their children. And I feel like that's every time they go there together, there's something new that mostly the perpetrator descendants learn. And they're learning that they were hoodwinked a bit by their history. And there's a lot of this, it's really complicated, right? Because people who want to reach out to the other side risk the approbation of their families. And there's people in Geraldton who were terrified that they were going to get ostracised by the family for asking questions about, you know, the grand ancestors of our family, the great you know, pioneering heroes. And they were, you know, there's a real risk to doing this work. But when it happens, it's so meaningful and so powerful. And I think, you know, you're talking about how country is a character in a story. That's true in our lives as well, because the country holds those stories. Being at Bootnell Springs with the descendants of all sides was so overwhelming, because the country is still alive with that story. You feel it there. You feel those people there who lost their lives. But you also feel the dreaming story, and as well, you know, like the story of Bimra, the creator who made that waterhole, is there too, you know. So I think the way that Fiona Counsellor, who's one of the descendant family survivors, says, you know, the new things can grow here. And what they're trying to do is grow something new that kind of brings a healing, or brings that story together. So there's the other person I'm thinking of now is Bruce Baskerville, who's a descendant of a perpetrator family. He said, we need to get to an agreed truth about what happened. It's not your history, my history. The more we talk together, the more we get to a story that we can all live with and should live with, you know, because the stories we have now don't match. And until we can come to a place where we're all recognize that we're here together, we can build something new, if you know what I mean.
All right. Well, we've got some time for some questions for Lorena or from Angie. Yes, there's one here. I'll just wait for you to get the microphone.
That was wonderful. Thank you. My question's for Lorena. I might have picked up too much on something that you used as a throwaway line, so I'm sorry if I've done that. In Frontier Violence, we know there was a way of coding the word murder. For example, we dispersed the Aboriginal people. And the reason that was done was because under British law, common law, Indigenous people became British subjects. Mm. So if you said we murdered them, you might force the police to take action. Mm. You said that your man had an element of shame about what he did and coded it. But where did you pick up it was shame rather than self-preservation?
The fact that, well, in his historical context, people were quite open about violence at that time. So, you're quite right. We were British subjects, so it was the idea was you shouldn't do this because you're going to, you know, the questions are being asked in the old country about the way that people are behaving on the frontier. So you'd be a bit secretive about it. So you would use euphemisms like dispersal, or we'd go and, you know, teach the natives a lesson. And there's just language is replicated across the country. I know this because as part of one of the other projects I did with the late Professor Lyndall Ryan was to turn her massacre map into a project for The Guardian called The Killing Times. So that language was very common. In his case, he coded very direct language. He said, I killed, I shot. It was quite, he was quite clear. His way of hiding it was to use this code, this pig pen code, to, he still wrote about it, but used the code instead. Does that answer your question? I'm making the assumption that he's sufficiently shamed to not use that we dispersed the natives. So he used a code to write about it rather than use that language in English. So I think he could have done that, but he was also aware, I think, that, you know, if someone were to read his diary, he might get into trouble. So that's where I think that came from. I'm attributing feelings to him. He may not have felt shame at all. It might have been disturbing to, you know, he needed to write it down in some way to deal with it. Why else would he write it down? I mean, it's fascinating to me that he wrote it down at all.
That massacre map project also on The Guardian while you're looking at Lorena's journalism. Got another question for Angie or Lorena? One right in the middle.
In your writing, has there ever been anything that you've put down on paper and then in yourself have thought, the people that are reading this, it might be too much, it might be too deep, it might be too traumatizing, and then either taken it out completely to save for another day or rewritten it in another way? And what would that be if you have done that?
That's a great question for both of you.
Yeah. I took out an entire scene from Melaleuca. So I think I wrote it because I needed to go into that headspace myself a little bit to feel it, but also to understand the plot. So it was a scene of sexual violence. I remember writing it in the morning. It took me about 2 hours. I walked out into the back deck where my husband was sitting having a coffee, and he looked up at me and said, "What is wrong with you?" And I was just like, whoa, I just have been somewhere. And I ended up rereading it and realizing that's not necessary. It's too gratuitous in a way. It's just unnecessary. I ended up taking a little bit of dialogue from it, and I felt like that was enough and even more than enough. You know, sometimes less is more. And I let the reader imagine then.
It's a very different question for you, Marina. But
well, the answer is no. I don't edit things out. I mean, my job as a journalist is to report. So I don't, I put it in. And that is the reporting, that is the story. We've published some horrendous things, but I do think that this is our history. We can't hide from it. We shouldn't hide from it. We shouldn't continue to sanitise it or to censor it. And so telling all of those stories gives us a sense of a mosaic of history. It's not this or that. There's a whole lot of stories. There's a lot of stories. There's a lot of grey areas. In fact, that's where the people live. That's where we all live, in the grey areas, that we have to live with complexity about the past. It was not all of this or all of that. There's lots of messy stories in there, and it's a sign of maturity, I think, as individuals and as a nation, that we can live with all of that.
Well, unfortunately, we have to leave it there. Thank you for spending time with us. And can we thank our panel, Angie Faye Martin and Professor Lorena Allam. Gabaninda.
That's Professor Lorena Allam and Angie Faye Martin. They were speaking at the recent Bad Sydney Crime Writers Festival. Also a highlight at the festival was the award of the Non-Fiction Prize for Crime Writing to Amy Maguire for her book Black Witness. That's the show for now. Join us again next time for more stories from across Indigenous Australia. Speaking Out is produced by Janaea Gibbs-Muir and Nadine Haynes. Our senior producer is Jay McAllister. And as always, you can find us on the ABC Listen app or on social media via ABC Indigenous, along with our Titter Show Away, hosted by the wonderful Rudy Bremer. I'm Larissa Berendt, and this is Speaking Out.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.